And I believe that one drew about 5,000 people. So the place was packed and right up to the front of the stage, a lot of commotion, a lot of noise, and a lot of excitement.
So you were treated like rock stars.
We were.
That must have been a good feeling.
It was great. That was probably our most successful of all the other cities, because the five-state area we had, our record was popular in the corners of the state, you know, La Crosse, Duluth, Fargo, Sioux Falls. We did real well in those cities. But Lincoln was a special place.
What were the Battle of the Bands?
Battle of the Bands, Tom, was when a promoter or a booking agent, but there were a lot of independent promoters too, not just the agents. They would rent a place and they would promote through flyers and word of mouth and through the radio a big dance. And the idea was to get two good bands and set them up at sometimes at different ends of, depending on the venue, sometimes different ends of the gym or ballroom, or if it's a big stage, they just share the stage. But it was a battle to see who got the most. They'd either vote or applaud, but it was a way to generate excitement. The two bands might be totally different. You might get a band like, you know, the Jokers Wild playing and then Michael's Mystics playing. So rock versus R&B, and that was always a battle between the bands that played rock and the bands that played rhythm and blues back then.
So there was a distinction between these two types of bands you mentioned.
That's my recollection of the ones we did. There may have been some where they just had bands. There were an agent put his, you know, three or four bands up there and just had kind of a battle of the bands. But it was a multi-band venue, which was always fun. You'd play, maybe just play one set or maybe two, but give it your best shot.
Do you recall any bands that you played with during a Battle of the Band concert?
The best one was in northern Minnesota, and we played in, I believe it was Hibbing. I was going to say Hibbing or Virginia, but I think it was Hibbing. And it was Battle of the Bands, and this was in the Armory. Yeah, I'm sure it was Hibbing now. It was the Still Roving and Michael's Mystics. And they were a great R&B band from St. Paul, and we were two totally different kinds of bands. We were rockers, dressing like rockers, looking like rockers, playing some good rock music and some good selections, kind of obscure rock, and they were a real tight R&B band.
So how did the battle go?
Oddly enough, it was really, really close, as I recall, and maybe they beat us by a few votes, I'll say that. They beat us by a few votes.
They actually had ballots and counted the ballots?
They did. They did ballots there. Yeah, it wasn't a noise-making thing to decide who won. They actually had ballots, and I remember it was really close, and they squeaked by. R&B was real popular in the state, but I think up north, the bands that were rocking out a little bit did better. But in the city, and of course, that was outstate, they still beat us. But in the city, the bands, R&B was real popular for the dance clubs. So some of bands like ours probably weren't as popular at certain venues.
You've mentioned Jokers Wild and Michael's Mystics. What other bands are playing around town at this time period?
Well, my favorite band was the Underbeats, as was many others. They were just really solid musicians with great vocals, and they drew huge crowds everywhere they'd play. It could be any night of the week. The Del Counts were popular, not quite as popular as the Underbeats, but they were playing a lot and real popular too. And really back then, Tom, there was dozens of good bands that were playing all the time. So it's hard to single anybody out. And there were a few horn bands like the Hot Half Dozen that were popular, and you could pretty much get whatever you wanted, from a three-piece hard rock trio to a smooth horn band with nice suits and doing steps.
Were the crowds different or similar when you went outstate to play compared to the local Twin Cities clubs?
I think in the Twin Cities, the people got to see more, and they knew who the bands were, they knew who the guys in the bands were. That didn't diminish their excitement or their enthusiasm, but outstate, I think it was a really big event for a band to go out and play in Rice Lake Ballroom or Bloomer or Mankato or Rochester or Fargo, wherever it might be. And I think it was a novelty for and exciting for the band and the people coming to see the bands play. I call them fans or just dancers. To see a band from the Twin Cities was really a big deal.
At some point you made a connection with Warren Kendrick. How did that come about?
That came about through Pete May again, knowing Warren. He was from Duluth, and he had been working with a couple different bands. He was writing songs and producing some bands like The Litter, and I'm not sure, I can't think of who else. He had a couple songs, I believe, on the radio, and I think he wrote Action Woman, which was a Litter song. And he wrote a song for us. He liked our band, and we kind of fit the vein that he was working in and the kind of band he wanted to work with. So we did one of his songs.
What was the song called?
The song was called Jet Set.
Warren wrote it specifically for the Still Roving.
Well, that's how it ended up. Yeah, we got the song. I'm not sure if it was specifically intended for us originally, but it was a good fit for us.
Who sang lead on it?
John Howarth.
And what happened to that recording?
It never got off the ground, and it wasn't a bad song. It was pretty good, and I think we did it pretty good, but never got airplay.
Is there a tape of it today somewhere?
Somewhere.
Do you have one?
No. There might be a tape somewhere, but they used to call them acetates, too. We'd get a hard copy of a record that was the size of a 78 or size of a 33 RPM even, but it would have one or two songs on it. And that's lost. So if you can find Warren, tell him I'd like a copy. I can remember doing the song, too, and he was fun to work with. Very enthusiastic.
Okay, so the band has Hey Joe on the radio stations in town and in different areas across the country, and you're playing more and more gigs. What's the next chapter in the life of the Still Roving?
The next chapter was member changes, which at the time seemed like the right thing to do. And I guess they were at the time, but we didn't duplicate the success we'd had with Hey Joe.
What were the personnel changes?
Initially, Dan Kane had left the band. We'd got a real good singer from a local band. His name was Jim Larkin. He sang a song with us, which became our second somewhat popular song.
And that was?
That was called Little Picture Playhouse.
And that was originally done by what band?
An English band called Simon Dupree and the Big Sound.
And how did the Still Roving find out about this song?
Dave Dean, being a keyboard player, always liked songs with keyboards and maybe little catchy keyboard parts. And his brother studied in England for a summer, and he brought half a dozen obscure records with him, which turned out over a period of time to be some of the great records of all time.
So you're back in the studio with the new lineup. What band was Jim Larkin in before the Still Roving?
I think we saw Jim with the He-Twos, and I don't remember other bands Jim was in.
Okay.
He was a lead singer and he had a really commercial-sounding voice, and that was the attraction of Jim, is none of us had that commercial sound that you might hear with some of the bands that were popular. And he brought that to us, but Jim didn't last in the band very long. It was just several months, and then he left the band.
So Little Picture Playhouse comes out on the August label. Was that also a Peter May label?
That was Pete May's label.
And the flip side of this was what?
Cast Thy Burden Upon the Stone.
And that's an original song?
That is a song that Dave Dean created. Okay. With a keyboard hook, piano hook.
So Little Picture Playhouse comes out. Now we're in what year?
That would be 1968.
And what happens to the 45? Do you get any airplay?
We got some airplay, but it wasn't as successful as Hey Joe. But we got airplay in pretty much the same areas we had earlier. So it was quite popular in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Because it got airplay down there?
Yeah, it got airplay down there and did well. I don't remember how high it reached on the charts down there, but it was definitely a radio song there. And we were popular, so they would have probably liked anything we had done at that point.
So now you're up to having two songs on the radio stations.
Mm-hmm.
And the band is successful at this point?
The band's busy. We're doing well. We're trying to grow and learn the business better, which we never really knew the business then. And that was probably the most difficult thing, is to try to treat it like a business and not like a group of friends having fun traveling around playing music.
So you were a drummer. What local drummers impressed you?
I like Denny Craswell from the Castaways, was one of the first drummers I saw that was really good. And John Hughes from the Chancellors, when they were doing their kind of surf music, he was really fast. The drummer for, that worked with Dale Menton.
Bruce Watterson?
Yeah, Bruce was a great drummer too for a young kid.
Drummer on Run, Run, Run.
Mm-hmm.
Any other drummers?
Well, there are a lot of them. They were all good. They all seemed good to me, and they were all good and flashy. Others were just real solid.
What did the Still Roving have as far as band equipment? Did you have a sound person? Did you have a light show?
We had what a lot of bands had back then, was a PA and we would have a couple of band boys or roadies set up the equipment. We, for the most part, didn't mic our equipment, and we didn't use monitors for a long time. We played without monitors, so it was a very sparse setup. And then we got it hooked up with a music store and got all brand new equipment. We used all Vox equipment for a while, and that got destroyed in an auto accident, so we ended up getting other equipment. But we always had good equipment, but it wasn't the kind of things that you see now where you have like lots and lots of lights and huge PA and lots of monitors and a sound man to balance everything and run things. You know, pretty much had a guy out there saying, can't hear the vocals, turn the vocals up. It was very simplistic.
A video has surfaced of the Stilrovan playing live. Where was that and what time period was that?
That was at the Rochester Mayo Civic Auditorium, and that had to be, I think it was the end of 67, I think. That was with the original band still, and we played a three-band show down there. It was quite a big deal with the Castaways as the headliner, and then us, and then the Litter were the first act on stage. So they played, then we played, and then the Castaways, and there was a couple thousand people there, pretty big crowd.
From what I've heard, that was Bill Stranloff's last performance with the Litter.
That was. It was, and Zippy was there. This was a an arena, so we were in the locker rooms as we were tuning up and hanging out a little bit, and Zippy was down there, and Bill was there, and it was kind of an awkward situation.
What happened that night?
I almost got killed.
How?
The stage was real high, and I was standing behind the when the Litter were playing and getting my kit together and kind of just getting geared up and ready to go. And Stranloff was having a bad night, and he was not happy about being relieved of his job. And he was probably a little bit intoxicated, I guess. And at one point, turned around, and he kicked his amp off the stage, just kicked it off over the back, and the PA head, which was a pretty heavy piece of equipment, missed my head by, probably 6 inches to a foot. So he was quite apologetic afterwards, but at the time it seemed kind of funny, but it could have been a lot worse. But I never forgot it.
In this time period, there are hard rock bands now, The Litter, Joker's Wild. How did that affect the Stilrovan?
I wouldn't say it affected us directly at all. There was really very few bands like ours that weren't really getting into the R&B super commercial, and bands like, the Joker's Wild and the Litter were playing more obscure things. I think they had a little more edge than we did. We started playing more, maybe some things that had vocal challenges, if I may say that, and then we kind of moved into some of the West Coast bands, and I think we all had different song lists. If you went and heard the Jokers one night, you went and heard the Litter the next night, you're not going to hear the same songs, and if they went and heard us, they weren't going to hear the same songs, whereas some of the other bands, you're going to hear a lot of the same songs played by different bands. So I think that was something that was attractive about us.
What were the Dayton's top 10 shows?
Those were shows at the 8th Fuller Auditorium. It was a Bill Deal deal from WDGY, and they would promote, trying to remember if they would do the fashion show thing too, or if it was just the music, because we were involved in both of those. But they were venue where they'd have the 8th Floor Auditorium would be full of chairs. People would do kind of a sit-down thing, and they would feature a local band and then some type of national group to play there.
Did this occur on a certain day, Saturdays or weekends? Or
I think it was Saturday afternoons.
What bands do you recall seeing there?
I only remember one day there, and it was a fabulous Saturday afternoon.
Let's hear about it.
This was a band coming to town called the Yardbirds. At the time, the Yardbirds had some famous people in the band. We didn't know how famous they were really going to be, but as it turned out, it was an epic day for us, and we had a job that night in Rochester, which was really one of our most popular places to play. So we got there, we sat right up in front, and the first act was a local band called the Hot Half Dozen, smooth band, real polished, very good band from North Minneapolis, Northeast, I think. And they played a set, and then they got off the stage. They had to do a little equipment changeover, and the stage opened up with the curtains going back, and here come the Yardbirds. They were all wearing white, and they came out from kind of the back walking towards the stage, and they started out with Shapes of Things. Shapes. And it was really loud, and it blew her hair back. And on guitar was Jeff Beck was on guitar, and Jimmy Page was the bass player. Of course, we knew who these guys were, but we didn't know how great they really were. But that was the most inspirational job thing I'd ever seen, is watching a band play, and they sounded just great, and they had a bunch of hits by then. And the other original members, it was inspiring and loud. And so that afternoon, after that job, we hired the two roadies away from the High Spirits. We gave them the keys to our van, told them where they had to be, at what time they had to be there. We got down to Rochester probably about 15 minutes before, maybe a half hour before we're supposed to play, and all the equipment was set up. It's the first time we ever had people set our stuff up, and they did a perfect job, and it was flawless, and we played Louder Than Hell that night. We played on 11 before Spinal Tap. We had the amps up all the way, and it was the loudest thing on stage I can remember. Of course, with no monitors, even things like my bass drum wasn't mic'd then, and we just gave it everything we had and had a great time. It was the most inspiring moment of our career, was seeing the Yardbirds.
Did the Still Rollin' ever play at the Dayton's Top 10 Club?
We played for Dayton's in August. We played there. They had a venue which was their fashion shows, and they hired us to do these things during the day. They had them, they had kind of an event, a summer event, and we were there, the band. So we played all the, through the store in different parts of the store.
What year was this?
That would have been fall of 67. This was the back with the original band.
So this was a promotion to sell English-style clothes.
They had a shop there called Carnaby Street, right in the second floor as you come up the escalator, and it was this fairly small shop that was packed with authentic English clothes from Carnaby Street, and they had a English dude working there, and so we went in there quite a bit, and we bought quite a bit of clothes from them. That was our spot. But the fashion show was actually just modeling teen fashions, and you know, might be playing in the men's section. Next day might be playing down in the women's lingerie. No, I don't think that's right, but it was a good time. I don't remember playing at the ballroom. I think we did play there too, but I can't picture it in my mind.
Okay, we're on to your next 45, which is also on the August label, Come in the Morning and Necessary Person. What is the story behind these two songs?
Those we recorded after our personnel changes. We had a couple different configurations of the band, and one of the things it did was take us down to Tucson to play, because we had a record down there, and we played a couple of dances, and we played one big job down there, and we also played a club for a while. But
you were getting airplay.
We were getting Tucson. Right. We played a job at the Tucson baseball stadium. There was four groups there. The first was us. We played a set, followed by Brenton Wood, did a song called Give Me a Little Sign Girl. It was a big hit. And followed by the Sunshine Company. They were kind of a California folk rock band. And finally, one of the last jobs that Buffalo Springfield ever played, and they were one of our favorite bands. And we loved their music and played a number of their songs. And so that was pretty cool, playing the outdoor baseball stadium on a beautiful night in the desert. But that led to us playing a lot around the Southwest then in Texas. We were booking out of Kansas at the time, in Denver, so we were playing those areas. And the record we did was done in Clovis, New Mexico, with Norman Petty at their studio, which was kind of famous for doing the rockabilly music.